morning is case number 66022, Allen versus District Court, parentheses of the defending matter. Ms. Eccles and Mr. Plangus. Ready, Mr. Eccles?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you want to reserve some time on this?
I'd like 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, I'll try to let you know when we get to that point in case you don't watch the clock.
All right, thank you.
We're ready to go.
Good morning, Your Honors. Micah Eccles for petitioners. May it please the court. This is our writ petition to a vexatious litigant order where each of the petitioners were deemed vexatious litigants. The relief we're asking from this court is to vacate the order based upon Jordan v. State, Jones v. District Court, and a variety of other cases cited in our briefs. We've raised four issues in the briefing, and I'll take those in order. The first issue is the jurisdiction. Now, in the vexatious litigant order, it states that in every case where we've ever filed, regardless of whether we were the plaintiff or not, that every filing was vexatious. Unfortunately, the order does not detail each one of those filings. All it does is issues a blanket, says everything we've ever filed. By my count, it was 13 different cases. The jurisdiction issue is NRAP 38 and FRAP 38. The case law construing both of those rules says it's up to the appellate court to decide whether that particular case is frivolous or not. Datex is one that's cited quite often by this court, saying, hey, that's reserved for this court. And of the 13 cases that are cited in the district court order, many of those are either pending before this court or have been consolidated. So the first reason, the jurisdiction argument takes care of part of the order.
Well, that's also covered by your overbroad argument, too. The same issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Okay. The federal case law construing FRAP 38 likewise says it's up to the appellate court to decide that. So that was just beyond the district court's jurisdiction. The second argument is the overbroad part of the argument. The main issue we have with this, and there was an ambiguity in the order where it says any actions in part of the order, but then it says, well, but it's limited to only these respondents. We asked the judge to clarify that issue in our objection to the draft order. He didn't, and so, you know, the way that we have to look at that is it means any actions anywhere in the state of Nevada. Regardless of whether it's any actions or any actions against only the respondents in this case, Jordan says that a determination of vexatious litigant cannot extend beyond that judicial district. And so here we have the judge making decisions for all of the other districts outside of the second judicial district.
However, though, Mr. Eccles, remember, a district judge is a statewide judge. Even though they may represent the second judicial district, they have jurisdiction statewide. But I understand your position on the case law. It should be limited to that district.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. Now, the other issue of Larry Allen hasn't filed any cases, but he was nevertheless kind of thrown into the bunch here with the other petitioners. GCI was the main claimant, so to speak, is for these mining claims. Ward only came after it made an assignment to GCI. Actually, Ward was first. It made the purchase and then assigned to GCI. But Larry Allen, he was only named as a defendant in this case. That's why he's a party of this case, and he was just kind of thrown in there in the vexatious litigant order. The other part of the vexatious litigant order that's very concerning, we cited the Cali v. Boeing case from this court, is the due process issue where it says any business that Larry Allen directs, owns, or manages also is thrown in as a vexatious litigant. We don't know what these other businesses are, and we don't know when they're going to try to pull this out, especially if you couple that issue with any actions in Nevada. So if we have some completely unrelated issue, we actually have had people start to already raise this vexatious litigant order to prevent us from filing counterclaims. We've been sued, and we can't file a counterclaim because of this.
Why has that issue? The vexatious litigant only means that you have to get permission of the court for the filing. It doesn't completely preclude you from any additional filing. Should we still be that concerned because of that's the interpretation? It's not a complete bar.
I think we should, Your Honor, because it's not really an order here that can be tailored. Another one of the problems in the order is we don't know by what standard this is supposed to be judged. It says if anything's in Washoe County, of course it goes back to Judge Flanagan or the presiding civil judge in his stead. But if we're in, for example, the 8th Judicial District, and somebody brings this order and says, hey, you can't file a counterclaim, it goes to the chief judge, somebody who's completely unaware of what's going on in this case. They don't know by what standard they're supposed to judge this. And it actually came up recently in the last year in an arbitration. And so it's supposed to be a private arbitration where everyone agreed to the secrecy of the arbitration, which makes it even more difficult. And so now we have an arbitrator who's going to decide, hey, you know, I don't know if you can even file these counterclaims because of this broad language in this order.
Are we limited to vacate the order or affirm the order, or do we have the ability as a panel of the Supreme Court to rewrite the order? You said it could be tailored, but could we tailor it?
You know, Your Honor, you could definitely tailor it if you wanted to, excuse me. That's certainly an alternative remedy that we would agree with. And I think one of the easy ones is you've got to kick Larry Allen out of there. But, you know, there are so many different layers of problems with the order. But if the court wants to retailer that to, you know, a narrower scope, that's certainly something the court has the ability and authority to do.
We had that issue recently on restrictive covenants, on covenant not to compete, as to whether this court should be able to rewrite or not rewrite that. It's been a contested issue in this court. So I don't know how the rest of our colleagues, how these two colleagues would look at it, and also the other three, and then the new one who's going to be appointed would look at it too. So it's a complicated issue, Mr. Eccles.
Well, in reference to the case, Your Honor, I would say if you're going to vacate it, then don't get out the blue pencil, I think was the term from that other opinion.
So Justice Gibbons' word, blue. That's all.
The contradictory rulings. Now, this is an issue where we had gone through the different forms in this case. There were really two issues. The mining defendants really only have to deal with the extra lateral rights, the Babe Mines judgment that was obtained by default. The separate issue of ownership or a pathway to ownership of these mining claims only involves Alta Gold. Alta Gold right now is the title owner. In case number 63959 that's currently pending before this court is what we call the quiet title appeal. At the time we filed these briefs, we called it the 54B appeal because we all thought it was a final judgment. We came in February last year, and Justice Hardesty said, well, here's some outstanding issues. And so it's actually he consolidated some things. But if you look at just the language, the actual rulings, what Jordan v. State requires from the other courts, not the cherry-picked information that was put into the order, the actual rulings actually affirm that everything that we did from these courts in the different forms was okay. We weren't subject to sanctions. And so if you take the test for a vexatious litigant from Peck v. Krauser, that it's a collection of frivolous cases, we don't have a collection of frivolous cases. Judge Hicks, who heard the appeal from the Judge Zive bankruptcy case, he said there's nothing here worthy of sanctions. The Ninth Circuit on the appeal from that case, which was prosecuted by Beckley Singleton, Dan Polsenberg, and Joel Henry, two outstanding appellate attorneys, that they list in the order. They actually list all their names, say, hey, you had 16 attorneys working for you over the course of these 12 years. Well, why does that matter? But the Ninth Circuit order is key because it says, hey, you know, you might have some merit. If you look at both the Judge Hicks order and the Ninth Circuit order, the Ninth Circuit said there's nothing worthy of sanctions in any of the proceedings below in the district court or the bankruptcy. And then on appeal, they said there's nothing here under Rule 38 that warrants any sanctions. And so that's part of our contradictory rulings, but it also goes back to the jurisdictional argument. Another point that was brought up in the order is Judge Saltzman from the Riverside bankruptcy. Again, instead of relying upon her actual rulings the district court order relies upon some cherry-picked information which goes beyond the standard in Jordan. She said this was a bona fide dispute and legitimate use of the bankruptcy because of the 363 possibility of clearing title to the bankruptcy proceedings.
I guess I understand what you're saying. That's part of the argument. But shouldn't the court be concerned that there have been a number of, so to speak, dispositive rulings in this particular case, and the court is just kind of saying enough is enough unless you really raise something brand new that the court hasn't heard before?
Well, the dispositive rulings within the current case that's on appeal, Your Honor, those haven't been reviewed. And that's really another layer of error here because the partial summary judgment order from April 2010 that goes through, he says there's a dispute here on section 108C bankruptcy tolling. He said there's a nationwide dispute on this. And so really what that goes to is, we cited Baldwin Otto versus Wynn that says if you have factual disputes, if you have legal disputes, which are acknowledged in the record, then we can't have a vexatious litigant order. And so while there were a whole series of summary judgments, those were orders that were either pending before this court on appeal at the time or now are. And I'm down, so I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Reyes.
Good morning. I'd like to address one point right off the bat. Judge Flanagan's order was not as broad as Mr. Ellenbrook would have this court believe. If you look specifically at paragraph 3 of the order, and this is on page 16, the order applies to any claim of ownership to the mining claims, any claim of ownership of the extralateral rights, any challenge to the extralateral rights, and any new actions the Allen parties want to file in Nevada courts. And the interpretation is regarding those claims. I specifically asked Judge Flanagan about that at page 6263 of the record. And I said to the judge, your order seems to be limited to the number 2 and standard. There were also 82 unpatented claims that were involved. And the court said, we'll include those. The order is limited to lawsuits involving ownership of the mining claims and ownership or effects on the extralateral rights, period.
Even if that was true, counsel, even if that is true, the first part, the Allen parties, since the Allen parties, to my understanding, were not before the court, and there was no attempt to pierce the corporate veil, so to speak, you have to deal with those fictions. Is it too broad because they weren't before it, and now we're the district court's entering an order that applies to parties who weren't in that capacity before the court?
I'd like to address that, Your Honor, and you're exactly right, and let me point out why. This is not the easy pro per case. This is not the pro se litigant that brings a lawsuit against the governor and another one and another one. This is a sophisticated man who has a lot of money, as the court noted in the record. This is a man who uses corporate protection as often as possible, but he owns all the stock. He's the sole director. He's the sole shareholder. He tells the corporation what to do, and we're not trying to pierce the veil, as I pointed out in the brief. We're not trying to pierce the veil to recover damages. We're trying to stop conduct. When you own all the stock, and you're the corporate officer and director, and you're the only person there, you control the conduct, Your Honor, and you will control the conduct of whatever corporation you control. If you don't control Mr. Allen and any entity that he owns or controls, he'll form a corporation tomorrow, and he'll sue us tomorrow. And just as well as you know it, it'll happen. If Judge Flanagan hadn't made it binding on Mr. Allen and any corporation or entity that he controls, again, as a pre-filing order limited to the ownership of mining claims, he would cloud the title to those mining claims. And as I pointed out again, that same page of the transcript, I had just finished telling Judge Flanagan, what happens in the real world is investors will not invest. As soon as that title is clouded, you're done. The title company will not issue title insurance. Nothing will happen. So as a practical matter, the judge heard that, understood the issues, and said very clearly, It's going to affect conduct. And that's what the pre-filing issues are all about, affecting conduct. And that's what Jordan was all about. The problem is we're not dealing with pro se. We're dealing with someone who went through 15 different lawyers to get here. You might ask yourself, why? Why didn't one lawyer take all those cases? The inference is clear, because after the first set of lawyers went through it, they didn't want to do it anymore. If one lawyer had taken all those cases, I would have a much harder case, because I would have a hard time saying that that lawyer ethically couldn't take the next case, the next case, the next case, because that lawyer would be looking at each one and saying to himself or herself, I have good brains. But you might ask yourself why more and more lawyers were involved. Why didn't the earlier lawyers want to bring another case? Maybe they felt just as I feel. There was no merit in taking that case again, and again, and again.
But you're asking us to indulge in supposition, which we should not be doing.
The supposition is clear from this one point that Judge Flanagan found. It's not supposition, Your Honor. When Judge Flanagan made his ruling, he looked at the actual statements made. Golden Chain is the owner, but Golden Chain was not the owner. In fact, in the order, Judge Flanagan made it very clear. He said, as early as 2002 and 2003, in the very first case, Golden Chain admitted as early on, and frankly, this was the interesting part of the proposition, the statement that Flanagan said that everything was broadly the case. No, he didn't. In paragraph 6, he pointed out that in the complaint in Judge Elliott's case, he said, Golden Chain said, we're the owner of the plant. In paragraph 7 of the order, Flanagan states, in the opposition to the motion for summary judgment Golden Chain filed, they admitted they were not the owner. Then they came back in front of Judge Zive and said, we're the owner. Judge Zive pointed out, you are not the owner. They came back in front of Flanagan and said, we are the owner. Judge Flanagan was very quick to point out, documents were presented to you pointing out, Golden Chain, you're not the owner. You haven't foreclosed. And you knew you hadn't foreclosed as far back as Judge Elliott's case in 2002 and 3 when you admitted you hadn't foreclosed. You went to Judge Saltzman and you filed in bankruptcy and said, we're the owner. But you knew you weren't the owner. You failed to tell Judge Saltzman when you filed in her court that I had entered an order saying you had no right to foreclose. You didn't tell her that. You didn't tell her about it at all. You just simply said we have deeds in lieu of foreclosure. But you didn't tell her you don't have a right to foreclose. You heard the statement here about cherry picking. She made her statement that bankruptcy is a proper forum for filing a request for 363 before she knew all the things I just told you. Then she held everything in abeyance. Talk about cherry picking. Once she knew what was going on, she stopped it dead in its tracks. And what was Golden Chain's response? To withdraw their bankruptcy. Why did they file bankruptcy? If they wanted the bankruptcy, they wanted the forum shut. When they didn't get a new judge that knew nothing about it, they dismissed it. What did the bankruptcy accomplish? It changed the trial date from May of 2011, and I had to go back and get a brand new trial date in 2012. That's what the bankruptcy accomplished.
Mr. Feingold, let me ask you this, and I think we understand the history and some of the matters you pointed out. What about the legal issue Mr. Eccles is making, that Judge Flanagan should have restricted his order to cases pending in the Second Judicial District Court and not in the Supreme Court or districts outside of Washoe County?
Well, let's focus on the last one first. Jordan makes the statement that, and it's clear, in the Luckett case associated with Jordan, this court makes the statement that the case should have been limited to the 8th Judicial District. And in the Luckett case, perhaps that is applicable. Let's ask ourselves here, first of all, whether that is a jurisdictional requirement and a requirement of this court in that case, or whether that is a policy that needs to be followed. Ask yourself what the purpose of the restrictive order is here. We have investors who are trying to make an investment in property, and we have a problem with a litigant who is continually filing, claiming to be the owner. If that litigant files in pick a county, Story County, and my investors find out and have notice of that filing, that someone is claiming to be the owner, under NRS 111.325, We have a problem with race notice, Your Honor. There's nothing necessarily recorded in front of them, but if those investors have notice of it, are they fully prepared to go forward and invest?
Now, this security interest, I think it is, that Golden Chain had, what county was that property located in?
All of the property is located in Washoe County.
Okay.
If this court felt it appropriate to modify that order to Washoe County only and say that Judge Flanagan should have limited his order to 2nd JD because the property is located in 2nd JD, that may be appropriate. I even said in my brief that could be an appropriate limitation. However, you have to ask yourself, one of the things that Mr. Allen and his business entities have raised is they claim that there's an issue pending in the 8th Judicial. They claim that there's a receivership that should have been followed in the 8th Judicial District. They contend that they had issues involved in other counties themselves that somehow affected these orders. I don't know where Mr. Allen's going to file next, but what I do know is if you're an investor and someone makes a claim of ownership, is it going to matter whether that claim of ownership case is filed in Washoe County or is filed in another county? If you find out there's a claim of ownership, are you going to invest the money to close this deal and then the next $100 million to develop the mine? And the answer is, no, you're not going to do that. That's the problem. I think the judge recognized, I'm limiting this to ownership claims about the mine, which have been repeatedly misrepresented.
Well, I think Judge Flanagan would have jurisdiction statewide, because he's a state district court judge, and I think it was the Montero case, we held that he's a state, the authority of a district judge is statewide, even though they're located in a specific judicial district. But if it's in the Supreme Court or it's in a federal court or it's in a different, not in a state district court, I have some concerns about that. Mr. Eccles saying some of these cases may be in the appellate court, and Judge Flanagan can't make orders about that.
Well, very clearly, we know that an entity associated with Mr. Allen actually went to the federal court and actually filed a claim against the receiver and trying to affect everything we're talking about while we were here. Nothing we could do to affect that.
How could Judge Flanagan make an order that affects the federal court?
It didn't prevent that. He didn't bring that case back to Judge Flanagan. Frankly, the interesting thing is that case started in federal court. Aeronautical Leasing, Mr. Allen's entity, removed it to federal court and then brought the claims. I don't think that was an accident, Your Honor. I think that's exactly what was planned. It was a Delaware corporation Mr. Allen formed this time, and he used the Delaware corporation to get in federal court and then used the federal courts because Judge Flanagan's order couldn't stop it.
Can I ask you another question? It's kind of tangentially related to this. If Mr. Allen or his entities or these type of vexatious litigants that are still subject to Rule 11, under NRCP Rule 11, 18010 on attorney's fees for these, abuse of process, malicious prosecution, I mean, there's a whole panoply of torts or different things that are available potentially. Does that play into this at all?
It does and it does not. It plays into it in the regard that we still have those available to us, but Judge Flanagan expressly found that Mr. Allen was well-heeled and he didn't feel that an attorney's fees award would necessarily stem the tide. He didn't think that, and he specifically made that finding. He made that statement. I think that's not an abuse of discretion for him to make that determination that I don't think this is going to work. The concern that we have about Mr. Allen, you've indicated, Mr. Allen didn't file the cases. This is a unique situation where Mr. Allen knows what he's doing. He understands the use of corporate forms, even to the extent of using a Delaware corporation when it serves his purpose. The interesting point here is, what did Mr. Allen do? Well, here's one thing that Mr. Allen did do. Golden Chain, when it was under the control of Mr. Levine, Golden Chain never opposed the settlement down below, never opposed the settlement when it happened, never opposed the motion to enforce settlement, never appeared at the motion to enforce settlement at all, didn't file an opposition, didn't make an appearance, never opposed the settlement post-settlement, until Mr. Allen went to Allen Levine, got back what he needed to get back from Mr. Levine, which was control of Golden Chain, and once Mr. Allen had control of Golden Chain, at a point in time where our argument is all of those elements have been waived, there's no right to bring anything on appeal now because you didn't do anything at the district court level, Mr. Allen then brought an appeal on behalf of Golden Chain. I had filed a motion with this court to dismiss those appeals as being improper. This court determined not to rule on that motion to dismiss, and that's this court's, prerogative, understandably. But if you want to know what Mr. Allen did, those are the things that Mr. Allen does. Mr. Allen takes it upon himself to make this litigation as difficult as possible. But it's not just litigiousness, and that's the point. What did Judge Flanagan find? And that's really what this court needs to do. I mean, ultimately, and I have to say, it's difficult for me because I've lived this. You can kind of hear it in my voice. And for that, I have to take a step back and breathe a little bit. But what I have to say is, your job really is to look at what Judge Flanagan did. Judge Flanagan carefully and frankly meticulously looked at the Jordan standards, looked at the standards in DeLong that were applicable in Jordan. He went so far as to apply the Molesky standards and the standards that were outlined in Saphir, which were, you know, a five-part standard, and he applied every single one of those standards to this action. He didn't accidentally say all of the cases were frivolous. What he did was he looked at the exact things that were done. One of the things he pointed out, do you realize that what the Allen parties did when they removed cases to Judge Saltzman's court, they actually removed a case that was on appeal to your court and didn't tell her that. They used the state court case filing number and didn't even tell her that it was a Supreme Court case. I had to tell her, this is a Supreme Court appeal. And what they've given you is state court filing information. As soon as she found out it was a Supreme Court appeal, it was gone.
Can I ask you one last question?
Go ahead.
The individual real parties in interest here, and I'm going to, I don't want to, there's quite a few, so I won't mention all the names. Are they Nevada residents, or are they residents of different states, you know, like that?
All of the entities listed on the, I believe the caption, and I guess I need to know which caption you're on.
Well, it's Mitchell Fanning, Jeffrey Jones, Jeremy Jones, Danelle Fanning, Alan
Other
Day.
I'm just
curious. Are we dealing with multi-jurisdictions with residency of these individuals? And these
there are a couple of individuals who are involved in the Babe Mines extralateral right that are family members that are not residents of Nevada. Jeremy Jones, Jeffrey Jones are not residents of Nevada. Other than that, if I look down here, Your Honor, the Standard Chartered Bank, Credit Agricole, who are not really involved in today's proceedings.
Right, I realize the they're foreign entities.
But the entities that I represent, Mitch Fanning, other than these are the Babe Mines parties of family members, it's Jeremy Jones and Jeffrey Jones are not residents of Nevada. Other than that, the other parties are really all Nevada parties. They're either Nevada entities or they are Nevada parties.
Is there litigation in other states where parties are not Nevada residents, but they could be sued in their home state? That's not an issue here.
No. The only out-of-state litigation that was referenced by Judge Flanagan to consider was really the Riverside bankruptcy. And the reason we were in Riverside was that's Mr. Allen's residency. It's, GCI was here, and everything else was here, but Mr. Allen, we made a motion to change venue to bring it here, but he opposed that because he resides in Riverside and he wanted the bankruptcy there. And the court said that's enough for venue to keep it here. The resident of the principal in the bankruptcy was Mr. Allen because he's the sole owner of Ward, which is the sole owner of Golden Chain, and he's the person, so it's where the person resides. That's why the bankruptcy was stuck in Riverside and we had to travel back and forth.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Prime. Mr. Edwards.
There's one thing, Your Honors, that we pointed out in our reply brief, and that's the aeronautical case that counsel has brought up wasn't before Judge Flanagan. So it's really a Carson Readiness case where they've added some additional documents to try to illustrate their point. We didn't mind having those documents in the record because we were actually sued in the case. Aeronautical was sued by Alta Gold, and we removed that to federal district court based upon diversity because we didn't want to get hometown in Reno, an out-of-state resident. And so what ended up happening in that case, it was before Judge Jones in the federal court. He dismissed, we filed a counterclaim in the case. He dismissed the whole case and said there were two receivers. There's a receiver that's been part of these mining cases here, Angelique Clark. And there was also a receiver that predated her was still, according to our interpretation, in open receivership, Bradley Swan, which was before Judge Kathy Hardcastle years ago. And so Judge Jones looked at it and he said, based upon an extension of judicial immunity, I'm going to dismiss the whole case. Both sides appealed to the Ninth Circuit. We argued that earlier this year, and they affirmed. They just said, you know, if you want to make claims, go back to the receivership. And so that case is basically done, but it illustrates the point here is we didn't file that case. We were defending that case. And we won. You know, we dismissed their claims. So Aeronautical, you know, they bring that up. They say, well, Larry Allen just went and formed Aeronautical for the purpose of creating more litigation. He didn't do that. You know, the comment here about that there were the 15 different lawyers and that the inference was that nobody wanted to take the case. We've set that out in our briefs. There were different lawyers who worked on the case. The Judge Joe Hardy Jr. is the one who initiated this case. Of course, he's on the bench now. And so to say that everybody got, you know, dissatisfied with Larry Allen is just incorrect. Counsel made a statement that he's worried that Larry Allen's going to sue them tomorrow. Well, just the opposite's happening. I can supplement the record, but this isn't in the record. But earlier this month, the mining defendants have now sued all of the petitioners plus Alan Levine in a new lawsuit in Washoe County. And we're being accused of and ordered that we're the vexatious litigants, but now I have to defend another case that is basically patterned after when we were here in February last year before Justice Hardesty. We had the Rule 33 conference. We were talking about how do we get to a final order. We need finality so we can have appellate jurisdiction. Mr. Flangus had lodged a supplemental complaint under, I think, Rule 15C. Says, I have all these other claims. And so I asked Justice Hardesty, I said, well, what are we going to do with those supplemental claims? Because they would destroy finality in order to bring this 54B or this quiet title appeal before the court. Mr. Flangus agreed to withdraw his motion to amend. He actually did that. He filed a notice of withdrawal of the motion. But just last week, he's refiled it as a new lawsuit in Washoe County. If the court wants, we can submit a supplemental filing. But it just doesn't make sense, Your Honors, where they're saying that they're feeling threatened, but then they turn around and sue us. In that new lawsuit, the way that the paragraph reads in this order, paragraph 3 on page 6385 of the record of this order, we might not be able to file a counterclaim in that case to argue, for example, you know, preclusion or anything else. I mean, we can obviously put that in a motion to dismiss. But now there's a serious question of if we don't get a dismissal granted, how are we going to deal with that case because of the way this order is vague?
But you could raise affirmative defenses, couldn't you, in the answer?
We could, Your Honor. But if we want any damages, for example, we'd be precluded from doing that.
Without leaving court, as it seems right now.
Correct. If there are any other questions, I'll submit it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Flangus, yes?
Could I have one thing? All of that discussion was entirely outside the record of this court. Could I have 1 minute just to respond?
I'm going to give you 1 minute, and then I'll give Mr. Eccles 1 minute to respond to you. I think that's fair.
Everything Mr. Eccles talked about in this new complaint was entirely outside the record before this court. It is true that I filed a complaint, and I will tell this court why. 4 years ago, on September 4th, we put a settlement on the record. That settlement was oral. I was worried that the statute of limitation on the breach of a settlement, a breach of an oral agreement, is running. And I have no doubt that this group over here will try to claim that their breach of the settlement agreement is barred by the statute of limitation. I apologize to this court, but frankly, that matter that is now on appeal that we contend they have no right to appeal has been pending for so long that I felt I was pushed to the point where I had to file a lawsuit to protect my clients from the running of the statute of limitations. So I filed the case on September 2nd, which was a couple of days prior to the running of the statute of limitation. It's the same lawsuit that I brought essentially right before Judge Hardesty brought us in. But I filed that case to prevent the running of the statute of limitation, and I stated so in the complaint that I filed. But I find the fact that it's brought up at this hearing, frankly, is irrelevant to this court's determination, but if you wanted an explanation of why we filed it, that is exactly why we filed it.
Was this settlement agreement entered into in court, or was
this? Well, we believe that settlement agreement was an agreement, and it was entered into, it was put on the record on September 4th, but if it was an agreement, it's a contract, Your Honor, and if there's a breach of that contract.
Did the court enter an order approving the settlement agreement?
Or? That is what is on appeal.
Okay, well, I won't get into that. Maybe we're going to have that down
the
road.
That is the whole point.
Okay.
Our contention was when we put it on the record on September 4th, we were embodying that settlement. The question of when it was breached, well, I didn't want anyone saying it was breached on September 5th and you waited too long to bring an action against us on the breach, and then I would be barred by the statute of limitations. So,
thank you, Mr. Fleming. Mr. Eccles?
Thank you.
Your Honor, Mr. Fleming's point is well taken. That lawsuit was not part of the record, and I prefaced my statements that it was a Carson Ready-Mix issue, same as the aeronautical. Now, the problem I have with this new lawsuit is 63959, which we've called the quiet title appeal, already has the same issues from its complaint, whether there was a settlement or not. That's one of the threshold questions in that appeal, and so that's why I brought it up.
All right.
It's not before us, so we don't have to worry about it.
Thank you.
I want to thank both lawyers for your spirited arguments in this matter, and both of you are well-known appellate attorneys, and you've lived up to the expectations that I've had with both of you. Excellent job by both of you. This is a very tough case for us. This matter will stand submitted.